Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on Do Foreign States Deserve Due Process, Minimum Contacts, and the Future of International Arbitration? Our moderator today is Professor Julian Koo. Professor Koo is the Maurice A. Dean Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Law and Faculty Director of International Programs at Hofstra University School of Law. He's also been selected as the John DeWitt Gregory Research Scholar and as a Hofstra Law Research Fellow. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Julian, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Okay. Oh, thank you so much, Caroline. And welcome to everyone who's joined this call. I'm really honored and pleased to moderate this conversation about Devis versus Antrix, which was argued at the court just this past Monday. And I'm honored to share a conversation with three of what I think are the leading experts on these questions or related questions in the country today. So we're really going to have a tremendous amount of expertise in the call today. This case really is about the nature of the federal court's power to hear cases involving foreign sovereigns and the larger role of U.S. courts in the enforcement of international commercial arbitral awards, which is a huge part of the system of international commercial arbitration in the world today. So I'm going to do a brief introduction of the case and some of the issues, and then I'll briefly introduce our panelists in more detail, and then we'll turn it over to them. So this dispute involves a government contract in India between two Indian companies, Devas and Antrix. Antrix is a wholly owned Indian government commercial company. It's an Indian government-owned company that handles their commercial space sort of business. There was a contract between Devas, which is a private Indian company, to launch satellites with for Antrix, but that was canceled sort of due to change in Indian government policy. And so the Devas-Antrix contract was canceled. Devas brought an arbitration action in under the ICC rules, and an arbitral panel sitting in India awarded Devas $500 million in damages. As we're going to talk a little bit about that, arbitral award was later set aside by the Indian court. But before that happened, Devas brought the award to District Court of the Western District, the Western Washington District, the Seattle Federal Court, to confirm it, which would then allow it to become a judgment creditor within the United States system. The Seattle Federal Court confirmed the award, but Antrix appealed, and the Ninth Circuit held, and this is the key holding, that because Antrix sort of enjoys foreign sovereign immunity, the only basis for jurisdiction is the arbitration exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which itself, the Ninth Circuit said, should be read, interpreted to require minimum contacts in order for the court to assert personal jurisdiction over Antrix, which is a state-controlled company. So this raises the questions for the court, which brought us to the court. The court granted cert to consider whether the exceptions to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act allow lawsuits against foreign state-controlled entities like Antrix, whether there should be a nexus requirement, such as a minimum contacts in the United States, in order to assert subject matter and personal jurisdiction over that arbitral award in order to confirm it. And second, in the background is a more foundational question, which we're also going to talk about. Do foreign sovereigns have rights under the U.S. Constitution, including the right to due process? In which case, it would require the statute to, or the court to find minimum contacts or something like it, or give the state due process in order to confirm the award. That's not something the Ninth Circuit quite reached, but the rights of foreign sovereigns as litigants in U.S. courts is a relatively unexplored issue, at least in litigation. Professor Brunk is the leading authority on this question, and so we hope she'll discuss this question we are going to discuss this question on this call as well. And I'll just say that the practical import of this case is about the system of international commercial arbitration in the United States. One important idea behind New York Convention is that arbitral awards from anywhere can be recognized and confirmed. And this would help boost the international commercial arbitration system. A rule going the other way to limit the ability of courts in the United States to hear cases, limiting their ability to hear cases involving foreign sovereigns could affect the way that system works. And the due process point is also important because recognizing a foreign state's right to due process in U.S. courts gives it a potential constitutional defense to statutes that would otherwise impose liability on foreign states, which Congress has decided to allow in some cases, like torts for terrorism, war crimes, or in some cases for human rights violations. So let me just briefly now introduce the three panelists. The first, we're going to hear in the order in the first issue from Professor Ingrid Brunk of Vanderbilt University School of Law. Professor Brunk, as I mentioned, is a leading authority on the question of foreign sovereigns, but so much more, U.S. foreign relations law, international law. She has many honors. I'll just note that she also is the current co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of International Law, which is the leading peer-reviewed journal on international law in the United States. We'll also hear from Professor George Berman from Columbia Law School, who's a world-renowned authority on many topics, but especially in this case, transnational litigation arbitration. Among many other honors, he was the chief reporter for the American Law Institute's restatement of the law, the U.S. law of international commercial and investor-state arbitration, which just happens to be touched on in this case. And then finally, we're also joined by Professor Paul Stephen of UVA Law, who I like to say is kind of expert in almost everything. And among other things, he was also the chief reporter for the administrative reporter for the restatement of U.S. foreign relations law of the American Law Institute. So we really have a tremendous amount of expertise here. So to kick off our discussion, I wanted to start with Professor Brunk and ask her to sort of lay out the constitutional question. First, the issue of foreign sovereigns and their whether they have constitutional rights and then how that might intersect with this case. And then we'll hear from Professor Berman and then Professor Stephen. So Professor Brunk, you go ahead.
Thank you so much, Julian and Caroline, and to our audience. There are at least three constitutional issues in this case, and I think it makes sense to lay them out really quickly. The first that you've asked me to address is whether foreign sovereigns are persons within the meaning of Fifth Amendment due process. The second and distinct issue is if they are persons, what process is due to them? That process might include minimum contacts, but it might also not include minimum contacts. And in fact, it might be the case that no defendants are entitled to minimum contacts under the Fifth Amendment. That issue is being litigated in another case before the court this term, Fold versus the PLO. And then there's a third constitutional argument, which I won't get into very much, but it's about whether state-owned enterprises should be considered as private corporations or as foreign states if there is a distinction in the process to which they are due. All right. I've argued against the tide, we might say, of the way most courts have gone here, that foreign sovereigns are persons entitled to due process. And I make that argument actually not because I have any particular stake in how these cases come out, but simply because the Western intellectual tradition in the 18th century is so overwhelming and incredibly clear on this point. If you read Vattel or any of the philosophers that were so influential at the framing, they build their philosophy of international law on an analogy between states as artificial persons, corporations as artificial persons, and real moral persons. And this language is picked up. It's a core part of Emmerich Vattel's philosophy, but it gets picked up by James Madison, James Wilson, Chief Justice John Jay, and many others in a wide variety of contexts repeatedly refer to foreign states as persons. In fact, this argument is so kind of clear and overwhelming. There's really isn't much of a response to it, except to pivot, I think, very quickly to two other arguments. One is, quote unquote, the structure of the Constitution. And then the second is a concern with policy outcomes if we hold that foreign sovereigns are persons. The structural argument is that foreign states are outside the structure of the Union. If you read Article 3, however, it extends the judicial power of the United States to controversies between a state, citizens thereof, and foreign states. And so there they are. Foreign states are right there in Article 3, and one of the purposes of the judicial power of the United States was to make sure that cases involving foreign sovereigns were resolved in a fair and impartial way. In conjunction with the language involving persons, the structural case that foreign sovereigns are entitled to due process is also overwhelming. The primary reason I think that people resist this argument is a concern with policy outcomes. And many people assume if foreign states have due process rights, they are entitled, for example, to minimum contacts in the personal jurisdiction context. That's not actually right. As I mentioned already, the Fold case shows the Supreme Court has never held that any defendant is entitled to minimum contacts as a matter of the Fifth Amendment due process clause, although the court has held that with respect to the 14th Amendment. Moreover, and more broadly, due process is a very flexible concept, and the interests of the U.S. government are consistently given very significant amount of weight in a due process analysis. In other words, it is easy to capture the interests of the federal government in weighing due process. There's also a very strong argument that due process entitles foreign sovereigns to nothing more than the process that Congress chooses to give to foreign sovereigns. This is an originalist and a really fairly conservative interpretation of the due process clause, but it's also quite a compelling one. The concern at the framing would have been that the court reaches out and does things beyond what the parliament or what Congress permits. And so what does due process do? It ensures that every defendant gets whatever the benefit of whatever Congress chooses to give you. If you take that view of the due process clause, and again, I think there's some really strong historical reasons to adopt it, then foreign sovereigns only get what Congress gives them. The broader point is to disaggregate this question about what process would be due to foreign sovereigns from the question of whether they qualify as persons in the first place. And we have so many interesting issues to get to. I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's a very interesting and important issue. I'll just note that I want to flag that this has, there's a lot of different angles to foreign states and U.S. courts. For instance, just this week, the case that the government of Mexico brought against U.S. bed makers. Now, these issues wasn't necessarily raised in that case. And then we have the upcoming case on April 1st that's going to be argued, which is Fold versus the PLO, which again, PLO is not really, no one sure it's a state, but let's put that aside. There's a lot of interesting litigation around these issues that is swirling around these questions that are beyond this particular case, which is itself very interesting. Okay, so with that, I know that this isn't the focus of your argument, Professor Berman, but I did want to give you a chance to talk about this issue as well from your perspective.
Well, thank you, Julian, and thank you for the Federalist Society for putting on this important program. You're correct, Julian, there are many issues in this case, and the fact is that most of the other issues interest me more than this one happens to. I also can't take great exception, much as you might want me to what Ingrid has had to say, because I'm not on Ingrid's terrain. That is to say, I don't know as much as Ingrid does in constitutional history, to opine on what the founders would have wanted or would have expected by way of due process to foreign states. I as an original matter, I sort of like due process. So I would like, I'd like everybody to enjoy due process. And I don't see why states shouldn't be able to do so. However, we do have pretty established law here. I think pretty established law, rightly or wrongly, that states are not entitled to due process protection. And I remember, so far as I remember, the main argument was in Katzenbach, but people can correct me. In the Katzenbach case, the Supreme Court essentially noted that if U.S. states don't enjoy due process, and by the way, I'm not sure why they shouldn't, but if U.S. states don't enjoy due process, a fortiori, foreign states shouldn't be entitled to due process. Now, when Ingrid says, you know, the view I'm expressing is prevailing, I don't think it's prevailing because people think it's a good result. At least that's my view. Not that it's a good result, but that it appears to be the established law. And so it's for that reason, Julian, that I didn't linger over this particular question in a case that raises so many others that are going to be with us more frequently than this one is going to be with us. So that's my response. And I'll leave it there if I can, Julian.
Okay, and I'll give Professor Brock a chance just quickly, if you want to talk about that interesting question of the comparison between U.S. states and the foreign states. But before I did that, and I take your point that this is not the main issue at the heart of this case, although I think it does color it, as we'll see, because it does affect maybe the interpretation of the statute. So, but I do want to give Professor Stephen a chance to jump in on this as well.
I'll try to be quick, Julian. Thank you. Thank you to the Federalist Society for thinking to include me. I have no reason to understand why, but I'm grateful to be here. First of all, I recommend Ingrid's scholarship on this point greatly. I'm tremendously informed about it, and she is the expert. I'll just say a couple of contrarian, maybe three contrarian things. One is, I think originalism as a general strategy to attack constitutional problems isn't very helpful. Some cases it is, but not as an overarching strategy. And I think in personam jurisdiction in particular, so I would rather approach this not as are foreign states entitled to constitutional rights in general, but whether the in personam jurisdiction rules of due process apply to foreign states, because that is a context where the United States is reaching out, if you will, where the United States is the aggressor by seeking to haul somebody into our system. And I think you can analyze that problem without thinking about other contexts as well. I think that a case can be made based on a notion that when courts exercise state power, the same general constitutional rules ought to apply independent of the persons against whom or against which state power is applied. And to George's point about the established law, we've got a throwaway dictum by Justice Scalia, my revered and beloved friend, I might add. But it was only throwaway dicta. The several courts of appeals have jumped at the doggy treat, but there hasn't been any really serious analysis of the problem, I think. And I think, and even if you go back to Katzenbach, it's a throwaway remark and it's not about in personam jurisdiction. So I think the law is unsettled, not that it's clearly one way or the other. And then my very last point, the fold issue, the idea that due process is based on Rechtsstaat conceptions of the rule of law rather than Dicean rule of law concepts, that bothers me a lot. I'm not saying it's wrong. I don't know enough. But the idea that Congress can choose what process it provides is to me disturbing. The Fold case is to me disturbing. And the one thing I will say with confidence is I'm pretty sure this court in this case is not going to address that question.
Okay, I do want to give Ingrid a chance to talk about actually both of those responses, because I this is kind of they're both kind of interesting questions to raise on her basic point.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. You did a great job responding to George on my behalf on the well settled point. I would only add to that, George. I mean, there have been a number of lower court cases that have held that foreign sovereigns don't have due process rights. It's unclear how many of those cases would come out differently. You know, certainly if foreign sovereigns have due process rights, but they only get what Congress gives them, then none of those cases come out differently, which is another strike against them being well settled. And even if we accept some kind of minimum contacts or consent based basis for waiving or due process, that too resolves many of the cases. So in this case, for example, it would be easy enough to hold that the defendant is entitled to due process and that they have consented to the enforcement of this arbitral award, and that's the process to which they were due. So I don't think we'd have to really parse carefully to see how many cases would actually come out differently. I think your points about Fold are good and important. I want to say one thing about originalism here. One of the problems with the court saying that foreign states have no due process rights is that private corporations have due process rights. And so then the courts are stuck with what to do with state-owned enterprises. Are they a private corporation with due process rights, or are they a foreign state without due process rights? And the reason this is so difficult is because the doctrine has no constitutional basis. There's simply no basis in the Constitution for distinguishing among these entities. And so courts, of course, can't figure out how to characterize a state-owned enterprise because there's no con law to back up that distinction at all, except some throwaway dicta in Weltover. So the point is, there's not a great sort of modern body of law to stick in there and say, oh, originalism, we shouldn't do that anymore because we should be doing this other thing. It's entirely unclear what the other thing is that we might be doing. And I think actually an originalist approach makes a great deal of sense to resolving this issue. But let's get to the fun statutory questions now.
Okay. No, thank you. And I think keep flagging though that this is a great philosophical question as to really what kind of law we should be applying, what principles should we be applying to this kind of unusual situation. Let's talk about the statutory issue, go straight on to it, there's a lot of different ways to characterize it. But the basic idea is there's a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which the general rule is foreign states can't be sued unless an exception applies. And the exception, there's a variety of exceptions. The most relevant one here is the exception for arbitration. I don't have the exact language here, but I want to start with George. Maybe you can make me lay out your view on how the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act you think would work or should work in this case.
Okay, good. Well, we're going to leave the waiver exception aside. Most courts are sticking with the arbitration exception. Now, if an exception is established, then the FSIA tells us there is automatically personal jurisdiction and automatically subject matter jurisdiction. And I can just say that was very controversial when the FSIA was adopted. Many people said the FSIA should only be about an immunity defense. I don't see why it has anything to do with jurisdiction. But in its infinite wisdom, Congress very clearly decided that once the immunity question is decided, the subject matter and personal jurisdiction question is decided. I don't think that ends the inquiry, and I'm going to tie back to what we've been saying, because by general understanding is that even if the FSIA establishes personal jurisdiction, due process is superior to a federal statute such as the FSIA. And so then we would get to the question of whether there is something unconstitutional about basing personal jurisdiction on the FSIA itself. I don't know when this is going to come up in our discussion, Julian, but I think Ingrid alluded to this. Consent is a is you know, a pretty well understood minimum contact, if you will. And then the very much debated question, and it is still debated, as to whether when a state signs up to the New York Convention or to the ICSID Convention, whether it has, you know, impliedly conceded jurisdiction, because the very purpose, jurisdiction to enforce an award, because the very purpose of those conventions was to guarantee enforcement of the award. So not to take up too much time, the FSIA will surface again later in this conversation, I hope, when we get to the question of the nexus that is required with the United States. But the last thing I want to say about the arbitration exception was that the arbitration exception says that the subject matter that must be capable of arbitration in order for the arbitration exception to apply. And a great deal of the oral argument on Monday turned on what subject matter capable of arbitration means. And I don't know if this is a good time to go into that or not, Julian, but I think the petitioners are correct that the correct way to read that is that the award, in order to be enforced, must be an award on a claim that is subject to arbitration. In other words, arbitrable in our usual sense of the term. And I'm quite sure, it's my firm view, that that is what Congress meant. A dispute must be one that is allowed to be arbitrated if we're going to enforce these awards. And I think Antrix was trying to find a lot more in subject matter capable of arbitration. And maybe I'll leave it there, but I think that's, you know, I think that should be resolved very, very directly in favor of it being arbitrability being simply a question of whether Congress can be shown to have decided that the dispute underlying the award was not arbitrable by law, which is not the case in this case. There's a lot more to say, but I'll leave it there, Julian.
Hey, yeah, so let's go with, we'll come back around on this one, but let me give Professor Stephen a chance, because I know that his view, his reading of this is different in some ways. It's all not in every way, but please go ahead.
Well, it terrifies me to disagree with George, because he is the foremost authority, certainly in the United States, perhaps the world, on these issues. And luckily, I've made a career out of being presumptuous and bumptious, even in the face of higher authority. So forgive me, George. You know,
oh, I will.
Just a little bit of background. So in 76, when the statute was first enacted, all of the exceptions had a nexus requirement. That is to say, there had to be some connection to the United States. And I don't think it was unreasonable. I'm not saying it was necessarily correct, but it wasn't unreasonable to say that each of those initial five exceptions, their nexus requirement was at least adjacent to, if not fully compliant with, minimum contacts rules. Except, you know, waiver is different because waiver supersedes contacts. But the other four all had a U.S. nexus. And so the Ninth Circuit, when it originally focused on the legislative history, which did say maybe we shouldn't count legislative history, Justice Scalia didn't think we should. But, you know, Congress did say everything we do here satisfies minimum contacts, so don't worry. You know, that wasn't crazy. And when the Ninth Circuit first decided that, at a time before the arbitration exception was added, it wasn't crazy. Might even be right. But then in 1988, we add the arbitration exception, and the nexus is not stated expressly in terms of territorial context, the U.S. or U.S. persons, but rather things like it being an award under the New York Convention, which is the nexus requirement that applies to this case. So the issue is whether the New York Convention, through a front or back door, might require some kind of contact. Now, as I understand Antrick's argument, the issue is, as George quite rightly said, arbitrability. And then there's an issue, well, who decides on arbitrability and whether under the New York Convention it's the state of the place of arbitration or whether it's the state where confirmation and enforcement is sought. And it is the Antrick's position that it's the latter. And that's not something I argued. I don't have an informed opinion on that. I detected quite a bit of pushback on the part of the court from that point, although I don't think they entirely understood this as a problem of interpreting the New York Convention. My view is that you can find this in the New York Convention based on the idea of public policy and that sort of fairness to the person against whom confirmation is being sought requires at least some minimum contacts. And that if the contacts don't exist, it's not it can be treated as not an award under the convention. More precisely, it's an award that the United States is entitled but not required to not confirm. Then the argument is that under the facts of this case, there was a lot less than a lacking a minimum context. It really was a zero context case. I'll end there.
Right. Just I'll give Ingrid a chance to talk about this. But I did want to say quickly, just for our listeners, in case you, this case is presents some weird facts. Right there, as I mentioned earlier, there's two Indian companies made a contract in India about something related to India. And so this is a good, the facts of this case are maybe not unusual, but the colors, I think, what the court's thinking about. But Professor Brock, I wondered if you wanted to jump in, and maybe you can take this any way you want, but maybe what you think, how do you think maybe if there is a constitutional right or background here, how that would affect the interpretation?
Is Ingrid?
Yeah, I want Ingrid, and then I'll
come back
to George. Yeah, thanks.
I'll just weigh in really quickly. I just want to clarify, because I think part of the discussion was confusing, that consent is not a minimum contact. Consent, in fact, the Supreme Court held as much in Mallory, right? Consent is an alternative way of satisfying due process. You can satisfy due process through minimum contacts, or you can satisfy due process through consent. And if you've consented, there need not be other minimum contacts. That's important constitutionally. It's also the distinction between waiver and arbitration exceptions to foreign sovereign immunity are also significant in this case, particularly when it comes to the question of subject matter jurisdiction, which is something the court focused on quite a bit. But I don't want to further, I'm happy to say more about that, but I'll let the rest of this conversation unfold.
Okay. All right. And sorry, Professor Berman, do you mind, you want to respond a little bit to the issues that Professor
Well, I can respond to Paul a little bit. I don't think, if anything, I would say that Congress's decision not to impose a territorial requirement on the arbitration exception is a reason not to make one up. It certainly could have done so. Congress deliberated and decided that it would confine. And you mentioned one of them.
Oh, can you repeat that? It froze up on my screen. Do you mind repeating?
Okay, I'm being told my connection's unstable. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. Just repeat what you said 5 seconds ago.
I said that if Congress did not include a territorial requirement in the arbitration exception, I'm going to assume it thought it unnecessary. Now, that doesn't answer a due process question, but we're talking about statutory construction here. And as you said, Paul, the waiver exception doesn't have a territorial connection. And quite frankly, the arbitration exception has been widely viewed as a specialized waiver clause because if a state signed the New York Convention or the ICSID Convention, the sole purpose of which was to enforce arbitration agreements and arbitral awards, and we know enforcement takes place in courts, it seems to me pretty obvious that Congress thought, well, we don't need it for waiver. We don't need territorial nexus for waiver. Why do we need one for the arbitration exception? When a state signs and ratifies the New York Convention or the ICSID Convention, what it is essentially saying, in my view, we waive immunity in actions to enforce agreements and enforce awards. So I don't want to read in a territorial requirement in the arbitration exception. I don't see any basis for that.
Paul, you can go ahead and respond to that, because I think and maybe you could also clarify. So what is your view as to what the right level of nexus should be? Is it minimum contact?
But
I'll let Paul state that first.
Okay.
So I think Ingrid was right that I was being confusing. I think I should future say that when we're talking about constitutional due process, we'll use the word consent. And when we're talking about the application of the exceptions of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, we'll use the word waiver. I think they are the same thing, but we should use different words to make it clear we're talking about different doctrines. So on the waiver point, George, the argument back in 76 was exactly that if the New York Convention was and ICSID conventions were both around, and people argued that, but not to Congress, that all the waiver you needed was when your state signed that treaty. The lower courts rejected that. And the reason that we have the 1988 amendment that added A6 is because that argument was rejected. The ABA committee had three different proposals. Congress was considering three different statutes back in 88. And one was a conclusive presumption of waiver based on being subject to a treaty party. And the state and justice at the time rejected that, and those proposals were rejected. So I'm not saying the Congress itself created a territorial requirement. I'm saying they created a nexus requirement under the treaty, and the treaty can be interpreted, note the way I put that, of including a territorial requirement under the public policy exception. That's the extent of my argument.
You know what they say about the public policy exception? It's what you invoke when you can't invoke anything else.
I understand.
Okay.
George, do you want to just quickly kick that on, and then I'll let Ingrid jump in on this?
On which point now, Julian, in particular?
I'm sorry?
On which point?
Respond to the point that, in 88 was really, is better understood as trying to include some sort of, to harmonize it a little bit with the other exceptions.
Paul is certainly correct. The very reason, for years, people were arguing successfully and unsuccessfully that the waiver exception covered our case. That did not win support in all courts. So my understanding is that Congress simply wanted to eliminate any doubt. Eliminate any doubt by establishing an arbitration clause on its own footing. And that's why I look at the footing that Congress place the arbitration exception on, and it didn't place it on a territorial basis.
Okay, I push you a little. So then what level of nexus do you think there needs to be? You think the treaty itself automatically is enough of a nexus? In other words,
I actually think it's enough. Now, I do want to talk at some point in our program about whether minimum contacts are required when the action is only to enforce a foreign judgment or award. But this is not the moment, right?
No, actually, we can transition to that. And why don't we go ahead?
Okay. Well, I think this is really something that didn't come up at all in the oral argument, but it's terribly interesting to me. It figured a lot in my amicus. Let us assume states are entitled to due process. Let us assume they are. Are they entitled to minimum contacts? Now, in the Schaffer v. Heitner case, which a lot of you know, the U.S. Supreme Court just about said that minimum contacts are required to enforce foreign judgments. To impose a liability, for a U.S. court to impose a liability on a defendant requires minimum contacts. And that was the situation in Schaffer. But in what can only be called dictum, I admit that, what can only be called dictum, the court stated and has been widely understood to mean that we have to distinguish between actions to impose liability and actions to enforce foreign judgments that themselves have imposed liability. That's not a distinction we often draw in civil procedure. But this becomes a really capital distinction, according to the dictum, admittedly dictum, in this case. So the court is understood to have said, look, we're going to demand minimum contacts when a U.S. court's going to impose liability that didn't pre-exist. That's that. But in a foreign judgment, all we are doing is giving effect to a foreign judgment that imposed liability. And if that court had jurisdiction, there's no reason why we shouldn't have jurisdiction to give effect to their judgment. And what we say about foreign judgments in Schaffer, I think, could easily extend to foreign awards as well. So I'm actually of the view that even if due process is available to states, that minimum contacts are not required. And the New York Convention does not, in fact, contain minimum contacts. I think we probably all know, you know, all that needs to be shown is that the award was made abroad, that the seat was outside the United States. I'm assuming commerce and I'm assuming reciprocity. But assuming commerce and assuming reciprocity, all that is required territorially is that the award was, the tribunal was seated outside the United States, which, by the way, Julian, and I'll end on this, I found very weird for counsel for Antrix to go on and on and on about how this case was entirely Indian, because it doesn't matter how Indian this case is. It doesn't matter if the foreign award was based on a purely Indian scenario, all parties Indian, choice of law Indian. All that matters is that the seat be in India. And I thought that was, I mean, I hope the court didn't get persuaded by him that enforcement should be denied because this is an Indian case.
So this is a great jump off point. So Ingrid, do you mind sharing, do you have a view on what you think, if assuming that you're right, that there's a due process of some kind for a foreign state, what the level of due process would be, would make sense for this type of situation?
Yeah, thank you, Julian. This is exactly why in my amicus brief, I think that this case should be remanded for, as a couple of us have noted, there are a lot of pieces to the due process argument. And, you know, my preferred result would be the court decides that foreign sovereigns are entitled, or persons entitled to due process, and then there's a remand to consider out exactly what that would mean in this case. I hadn't considered George's argument before about Schaefer. Of course, that's famously, you know, viewed as a quasi in rem a question about minimal contacts and quasi in rem jurisdiction. So I'm not going to hazard a view about, you know, it would depend on how, what approach the court generally took to the Fifth Amendment. That is, this question is kind of linked to FOLD and linked to just what do we mean by due process in the first place. If you take the view that it's just whatever Congress says, then a fortiori George's argument works well, because you're only entitled to what Congress gave you. If we're and this is another problem, you know, with constitutional interpretation here, you know, International Shoe, that put minimum contacts, started that analysis, you know, really isn't based on the Constitution, you know, which is fine as far as that goes. But then it does lead you to, you know, what do we do? How do we resolve questions in new circumstances? Do we just think through kind of the policy of due process and then try to apply it to the situation that George has articulated? That would kind of be the International Shoe approach. I'll just come back to where I started, which there are a lot of really deep issues here about which methodology we want to take overall. And I do think these questions should hopefully be decided in some consistent way methodologically.
Paul, did you want to, I'm curious to see your reaction to both George's ideas and I think that's the point, but also what is, to maybe state out, where do you think this is the right result would be in this case? Paul, could you unmute?
Sorry. Let me give you a micro answer and then a macro answer, more or less responding to George and then Ingrid. So on the Schaffer footnote 36 issue, I think there is a distinction between a domestic judgment, which has gone through domestic due process, and the only issue is this the right place to enforce it? Where it seems to me the implication of Schaffner that you don't need minimal context, you just need property, makes sense. I'll note in passing, this is a case where there is no property. There is a debtor, but no property. And I think that might matter. But I also think in foreign cases generally, you know, George, you know a lot more about this than I do, and maybe I misunderstand this, but I don't think all you need is a registered award, because you can raise all sorts of defenses to the award, as you have done. And I think you need an opportunity to do that, which would presumably, and this is where I get to the macro point, there's something to be said for having, you know, contexts that give you a motivation to raise the full ranges of defenses that you might make to the award. The same kinds of argument that Antrix made in the Indian domestic courts that you might be able to make here. More generally, I am a pragmatist with respect to constitutional interpretation. I'm a big fan of consistency. I don't think going back to 1789 or 1792 or 1867 is always the place to find that consistency. There are many of areas where that methodology, I think, leaves us wanting. We have 80 plus years under Washington Shoe. We've developed that jurisprudence pretty thoroughly. The court has not signaled. It signaled perhaps it has trouble applying it at times, but it hasn't signaled it's time for a major rethink. And I'm not a big fan of major rethinks. We're going through that in our national politics right now, and I'm not a fan of these major rethinks. So I would rather work with the framework that we have, rather than going back to first principles, which are anyone's to claim.
Okay, so let's focus on wrapping up. I had one question, but actually I think it's sort of answered, but maybe I'll raise it, which is if the, you know, how broad are we going to talk about here in terms of, I guess in a practical way, if we decide, I guess, that the court could end up maybe after remand, would we have, George, in your view, there's no connection required at all other than the award being registered in order to satisfy all the requirements, even a constitutional requirement. Is that fair to say where you are in this?
Yeah.
Okay. So then I think there's a question that seems like this is, you know, is that systemically makes sense because of the international of the New York Convention, but does it make sense for the United States as a policy matter, you think, George?
I think that's right.
Oh, I guess we're not going to find out. George, we lost George. All right, so let me just quickly, there's a kind of a general question I wanted to ask as we wrap up here, because I think George may not come back to us, is for both of you, where do you think we go from here, and what's the practical impact? I think both of you think, I think our prior discussion, or remand is possible, is likely here. But ultimately on this issue, where do you think the court comes out on the Nexus idea, if it does come back in full force to the court down the road? So Ingrid, do you have I hate to make you make a prediction, but a guess as to how this is going to unfold and maybe the impact, the practical impact on other cases?
Yeah, I just want to go take a second and go back to the colloquy we were just having. I do want to distinguish the Fifth and the 14th Amendment. So the question really here, we've never held that the Fifth Amendment requires minimum contacts. The Fifth Amendment was enacted in 1791, you know, half a century before the 14th Amendment. As much as, Paul, you love minimum contacts for the 14th Amendment, it's possible to have a defense, there's a bunch of reasons why we might distinguish for a variety of reasons between the Fifth and the 14th Amendments. And mostly I just wanted to highlight that as an academic point. We can decide that you don't need minimum contacts here for the Fifth Amendment without doing any harm to international shoe itself. On remand, you know, I think by far the cleanest way to resolve this case is based on consent, and that there has been some consent. And if the court resolves it in that way, even the lower courts don't have to decide whether foreign states are entitled to due process, as much as I desperately would like them to decide that fascinating question, because they can just say whether or not they're entitled to due process, they've consented to this jurisdiction. And if they've done so, then due process is satisfied. There's an interesting question about, you know, subject matter jurisdiction and whether subject matter jurisdiction can be waived. I think the appropriate way to think about that is if you waive your immunity from suit under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, then there is an exception to immunity and subject matter jurisdiction is conferred. You're not actually waiving subject matter jurisdiction. What you're doing is you are waiving immunity. And when you waive immunity, the statute says the court has subject matter jurisdiction. And that is subtly different from you have waived your subject matter jurisdiction defense. Anyway, that's all I have.
Okay. Paul, did you want to, Paul, as we wrap up here.
I do have a two quick points.
Sorry, I'm back. I got disconnected. I don't know why.
Okay, George.
I was in the middle of a sentence.
Okay, well, we're just wrapping up because I know you have to go. But maybe, Paul, do you mind? We'll let George go first.
Sure, of course. I don't mind at all.
Quickly, where do you think this is going to come out and what the impact will be?
Well, this is probably a good moment, if you don't mind, for me to mention the Netherlands case, if we want to be practical about this. You all heard, if you listened to the hearing, and you may have known anyway that this award was actually annulled by an Indian court. And so if it's annulled, that is a very different and in some ways a much easier line of argument that the award should not be enforced. The annulment of an award is a ground for denying enforcement under the New York Convention. And the position of the U.S., unlike France, unlike Germany, is that we respect annulments unless public policy was violated by the annulment. And we have the Pemex case there. So when this case goes back, assuming it does, I hope that the annulment issue is front and center. And that will require a discussion of whether the annulment decision by the Indian court deserves respect. And we presume it does. And if it deserves respect, then the award should be denied enforcement on those grounds. And we can forget about whether states have due process rights or they don't have due process rights and all the rest. And I simply want to add that, as I mentioned to the group before we spoke, I was informed by counsel for Entrix just today that the award, the Indian award, having been annulled, was denied, was granted enforcement in the Netherlands on the ground that even though the award was annulled, it was issued in violation of due process. Okay. So, you know, that's just a new angle on how this is going to play out in the Ninth Circuit. I mean, in the district court. Yeah, Ninth
Circuit. That should be that. So it kind of goes both ways. So although it sounds like so. Well, thank you so much. Paul, I interrupted you a little there. Do you mind?
Yeah, three bullet points. Responding to Ingrid on the difference between the Fifth and the 14th Amendment, I think there are many contexts where that is a very good point to make and a lot can be made out of it. I'm not sure the jurisprudence of the court, which is all I'm focusing on, has made that an important distinction with respect to in personam jurisdiction. Indeed, there are cases involving a federal statute, a federal court rather than a state, where the court has assumed that international issue applies. They haven't puzzled through it, but they have acted that way. And I think there are reasons to continue along that path, given my nervousness about abrupt breaks. I don't think there's either consent or waiver in this case, although both could be argued. There is a claim that Antrix consented to A6, but that is not a waiver of overall jurisdiction. I don't think a mistaken argument about A6 amounts to the waiver that would be necessary to overcome the subject matter jurisdiction point. And George is entirely right about Pemex and annulment. I have nothing to add other than to say thank you all for listening to me.
And thank you as well.
Thank you so much. And I know that people have to run. Carolyn, if you want to.
Yes. Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.